Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast, providing an exclusive look into efforts to conserve the wild things and wild places in Texas.
Hello, and welcome to the Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast. I'm Lydia Saldana with Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation. Today, we're going to explore native grassland restoration and why that is so important to so many species of birds and animals. John Hayes is with us today. He's a conservation delivery specialist with Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Thanks for joining us today, John.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Lydia. It's my pleasure.
We're going to call you the grass guy today, if that's okay with you.
That's fine. I've been called worse, so that works.
Okay. Well, the whole concept of grassland restoration is a very big topic, and before we dive into it, let's paint a picture for our listeners. Can you describe what the American grasslands looked like at the turn of the 19th century?
Yeah, sure. I can start by giving maybe some geographic context. And so when we think of grasslands in the central United States, really we're talking about a huge area that stretches all the way from southern Canada and, you know, Saskatchewan and Alberta, all the way down here to Texas. And, you know, we all learn of that in geography in elementary school is the Great Plains. And, in the west, it's bordered by the Rocky Mountains. In the east, it stretches almost all the way to the Mississippi River. And what that really is almost an endless expanse, what seems like an endless expanse of grasslands. In Texas, we're really the southern extent of that. When you start looking at these grasslands and you go west, it's up next to the Rocky Mountains. It's mostly what we call short grass prairie. And so with the rain shadow effect that the Rocky Mountains causes, it's a little more arid, so you don't have as much growth, and so you have shorter grass. When you move east, it gets a little taller, and you get what we call mixed grass. And into the far east of the central Great Plains, we're really into the tall grass prairie, and that's what most of our true prairie is here in Texas. So the early European settlers described Texas. One in particular, Cabeza de Vaca, talked about riding for days on horseback with grass up to the horse's withers without a tree in sight. So you can imagine what they saw was kind of this endless sea of grass blowing in the wind.
And a lot of people, when they think of endless diversity of animals and birds, right?
Absolutely. And so it wasn't desolate by any means. It was really teeming with wildlife. And so there were huge herds of, you know, tens of thousands of buffalo or bison, pronghorn antelope, things like elk we usually think of in the Rocky Mountains and in the forest. But there were absolutely huge herds of elk out in the prairie as well. And then, kind of out of a African National Geographic documentary, there were, big charismatic predators hunting all those animals as well. So the grizzly bears, there's a distinct subspecies called the Plains grizzly that lived and hunted in the Great Plains. And, the occasional mountain lion, and then big packs of gray wolves and red wolves down here in the southern prairie. So it was really a different place than we think of now in a lot of what we call the flyover states.
Okay.
And the birds are a major component of that as well, and that's what I spend most of my time working on.
So let's fast forward a couple of hundred years and tell us where we are today. What is the status of grasslands in the U.S.?
So the same thing that made grasslands in the central U.S. Productive for plants and wildlife obviously make them good for agricultural production as well. And so, this region of the United States is really responsible for providing, food, fiber, and fuel for the country and really for a large part of the world. So in the past, management for those objectives was done sometimes to the detriment of the critters that live there. Over 95% of that prairie has been converted in one way or another, and the result's been, more exotic grass, more of it in row crop agriculture, and even in some cases, some overgrazing. But in the past 50 years, we've learned a lot, and we've gotten a lot better at our ag production, and we've really learned that it doesn't have to be an either or. We can do both. We can provide great habitat, and we can also use these lands in a productive way. In terms of grazing in particular, most of those wildlife species and plants that depend on these grasslands actually need some sort of grazing to occur. So whether it was bison a couple hundred years ago, now it's domestic cattle, some type of herbivory is good for it. So a lot of those wildlife species that we already mentioned are going to benefit from that.
And I know there's lots of good stuff happening on the ground, and I know that a lot of the recent conservation efforts related to grasslands have been tied to quail, and also in recent years there's been an alarming decline in monarch butterfly populations that a lot more people are starting to talk about and has scientists concerned. So what's happening on the ground to conserve these iconic species?
Yeah, and so a lot of things have been blamed for declines in northern bobwhite and even monarch butterflies now. But by and large, the research always shows us that it is habitat loss. So it's loss of that native diversity and structure of those grasslands. Grassland wildlife depends on healthy grasslands. It's a pretty clear equation. So there's a lot of programs and effort being put into helping those grasslands recover and therefore providing habitat for that grassland wildlife. NRCS is a great agency. They have their Environmental Quality Incentive Program, Fish and Wildlife Service has their Partners for Fish and Wildlife Program. Our own Texas Parks and Wildlife Department has two programs that are aimed specifically at grasslands, the Landowner Incentive Program and their Pastures for Upland Birds, and then a partnership called the Oaks and Prairies Joint Venture that I'm involved with has developed our Grassland Restoration Incentive Program, which is specifically keyed on those grassland bird species, which we've seen decline over the last 50 years. So northern bobwhite, but also a lot of other birds like dick thistle, eastern meadowlark, loggerhead shrike, scissortail flycatcher. Even birders sometimes disregard a lot of the grassland birds, but once you really get to know them and get some binoculars on them, you see a tremendous diversity, even in those songbird species. So something like a LeConte sparrow is one of my favorites, and when you get a really good look at it, you see this beautiful sort of creamy, rusty sort of color to it. The scissortail flycatcher with that long tail and the beautiful salmon-colored under its wing. Really some pretty neat bird species are all in decline. And so that's what our GRIP program, a Grassland Restoration Incentive Program, is aimed at conserving by restoring the habitat that they depend on.
So it sounds like there's lots of partners involved on the federal and state level, lots of different programs. It all comes down to habitat. I imagine all of this is pretty expensive. How are all these efforts being funded?
Yeah, and so there's as many different programs as there are. There's as many different funding sources for these different things. A lot of it's federal. Some of it, like the NRCS programs, are driven by the Farm Bill. Specifically, our Grassland Restoration Incentive Program is primarily funded through a combination of state game bird stamp dollars and then private philanthropy. So when I'm talking about game bird stamps, some folks might not realize that when they buy their Super Combo license, they're also buying an Upland Game Bird stamp. Those dollars are dedicated specifically for conservation of those game birds, like northern bobwhite quail, but also turkey and pheasant and even chachalaca down in South Texas. So in the last legislative session, the legislature released a considerable amount of those funds to some projects that were administered by Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and one of those was our GRIP program. We were happy to be able to put 90% of those dollars directly into landowners' hands to help them do the good kind of habitat work that we needed done.
Now, John, I'm going to interrupt you because you, like many wildlife biologists I know, just love acronyms. I know what NRCS is. I know what GRIP stands for. Can you briefly explain what those two things are?
Yeah, absolutely. So NRCS is the Natural Resource Conservation Service. It's a department within the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So it's a federal agency with local offices and state offices throughout Texas. Our GRIP program is our Grassland Restoration Incentive Program that's administered by the Oaks and Prairies Joint Venture. So, yeah, it's kind of a hazard of the job in the acronym world.
Yeah. Now, you talked about an overview of those programs. Let's get into a little more detail about what exactly happens on the ground. What is happening on the ground to restore these grasslands?
Yeah, so generally most of the practices fall into kind of one of four categories. One of the most common things that we're doing in a lot of these projects is addressing that loss of native grass diversity that we used to have in those areas. And so in some places, especially in South Texas and coastal Texas, we've introduced exotic pasture grasses for the purpose of providing better cattle forage. The downside of a lot of those has been loss of those grasses that birds like northern bobwhite quail depend on, things like little bluestem, big bluestem, switchgrass, Indian grass. So what we do in those cases is we come in and do a native grass reseeding project. And so we'll actually spray herbicide on that exotic pasture grass, usually multiple applications. Then we'll come back in, most cases with a no-till seed drill, and seed a high-quality native grass mix in there.
Okay. Now, you know, when people are picking up this podcast, they're seeing a picture of you grinning with fire behind you. Can you explain what that picture is?
Yeah, sure. one of the most fun things that us biologists get to do is implement prescribed burns on private property. And it's a pretty neat thing to go out there and see 1,000 acres of grass go up in flames. But we don't just do that because we're pyromaniacs or anything or trying to have fun. There's a real need for that in the landscape. And there's a lot of science behind the benefit of doing that. Basically, it goes back to that notion of sort of these arid grasslands that are mostly dry, made up of fine, dry, dead fuel, that grass. And you can imagine, like, when you're trying to start a campfire, that fine kindling is the best stuff to start a fire. And so the natural condition of the grassland is to survive under frequent wildfires that move across it. Historically, those would have been caused by lightning strikes, or a lot of research now is pointing to Native Americans setting them on purpose. So all of these plants and animals evolved under a periodic fire regime. And so if we're going to restore the functionality of these grasslands, we not only have to restore the species through those native grass reseeding projects, but we have to restore the processes that helped propagate them, and so we're returning fire to those landscapes. It's going to push brush back in a lot of cases, open up the canopy to allow more grass to grow. It's going to return nutrients to the soil. It's going to cause a bloom of annual flowering plants. Nothing prettier than a prairie the next spring after you burn it. It's greener with more blues and yellows and reds and different colors than you've ever seen. And so it's a fun part of the job, but also a really rewarding one as well.
Cool. And I know you've referenced both brush management and grazing management throughout this conversation, and both of those things depend on private landowners. Can you talk a little bit more about the partnership with Texas landowners?
Yeah, it's really, I think, most biologists on the ground would say the same thing. It's really one of the big pleasures of the job, and one of my favorite parts is just riding around, kicking dirt, talking about the land with private landowners. In my experience, the landowners in Texas place a high value on wildlife, and not just for hunting and fishing, but also just viewing and hearing and seeing, and that's a real privilege to get to work with those folks. I think most of the landowners that we work with operate under the sort of that notion that they're just borrowing the land, and it's about stewarding it for future generations. And that's really rewarding for us to get to work with folks like that. So we really depend on those landowners. 95% of the land in Texas is under private ownership. That means, 95% of the wildlife, 95% of the rainfall, 95% of the soil, that's all happening on private lands. And so we need to partner with those folks, and it's about finding those sort of shared benefits and working together to reach them.
Now, lots of folks who are listening may be wondering how they can get involved, whether they're the landowners you just mentioned or maybe landowners that aren't aware of what they can do, or just citizens who want to help. How can people get involved?
One of the first things I always recommend to private landowners in particular is to get in touch with your local wildlife biologist. We have Texas Parks and Wildlife biologists assigned to every county. You can go to the Texas Parks and Wildlife website and go to Find a Biologist and actually click on your county, and you'll find the office and the phone number where to reach them. you're not putting those people out by calling them. We're sitting there waiting for you to call. We love to work with private landowners, and it's really fun to get to do projects like this where we get to talk about habitat. And so I would definitely encourage any private landowner to get in touch with their local parks and wildlife biologist. There's also a lot of other people out there that are doing that can provide a similar kind of help, whether it's the NRCS that I mentioned earlier or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service staff. And then there's a number of NGOs that also provide some kind of support. So, get out there, do a little internet search, find the resources you have, but definitely call your parks and wildlife biologist and they can give you some real help.
What about people that don't have significant acreage? You know, people that, like me in Fort Worth with a yard and I want to attract wildlife, what are things that I can do to help in this effort? Not just but other people.
Yeah, so we mentioned monarch butterflies earlier, and one of the limiting factors for monarch butterflies is they're traveling north, and they're very long migration. They're multi-generational migration from Mexico up to the northern Great Plains and then south again. One of the things they need is milkweed along the way. That's where they lay their eggs and where their caterpillars feed and eventually turn into butterflies. And so those milkweed plants, those native milkweeds, things like common milkweed, green milkweed, these species, just a plant or two in the right place can provide the needs for a monarch butterfly. Most of the habitat recommendations say that they only need one of those milkweed plants per acre. So we don't need a huge amount of area. We don't need a ton of these plants. If you're into native gardening and want to garden for wildlife in your area, I think that's a great thing to do. Plant one of those native milkweeds out there, and you might get lucky and see some butterflies come through. Now, you're probably not going to want to try to manage for quail in your backyard, but you can definitely help some of the little critters if you do it the right way.
Some of us are managing for things like dove. I swear I've got hundreds of dove in my backyard.
Yeah.
It'll be a sanctuary come September 1. Are there other places that you can visit? Are there places where people can see what these restored grasslands look like in a state park and wildlife management? Are there places people can go to see what a restored grassland looks like?
Yeah, so it depends on where you live in Texas. There's usually something within some driving distance. Obviously, in most cases, they're going to be a little ways from town. But that's good. You know, it's good to get outside and see the country. I'd encourage anybody to go look at Parks and Wildlife website and look at our wildlife management areas and find one of those nearby and look what they're offering. A lot of those have some great habitat. Some of the real sort of jewels of the grassland public land system in Texas, though, include places like the Atwater's Prairie Chicken Refuge. So if you're in the Houston area and you travel west on I-10, just south of the highway there near Eagle Lake is the Atwater's Prairie Chicken National Wildlife Refuge. And you can't access the whole place, but there's a couple great trails that you can really get out there and see one of the best examples of intact coastal prairie. Up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, there's a couple of TN Nature Conservancy properties, the Clymer Meadows to the east of Dallas there. I'd encourage you to look that up on the Internet. It's a beautiful place that's been restored for a number of years. They were even grazing buffalo there still. And then the Forest Service manages a number of grasslands, the Caddo Grassland and the LBJ Grassland. Both of those are up, one's on the east side and one's on the west side of Dallas-Fort Worth. And,
okay, now I'm a volunteer for the Fort Worth Nature Center, so I get to throw in a plug for the Fort Worth Nature Center.
I should have mentioned the Fort Worth Nature Center. They also have a herd of buffalo out there as well, and so that's a really cool one, and they've got some great restoration sites and some great examples of prairie. I think prairie is something that's really underappreciated, and even if it's just one morning, you get out there early, you kind of see the land wake up and take its first breath and hear those birds start calling and the dew's still on the blades of grass. It can really be a beautiful place. And if you have the good fortune of being near the Fort Worth Nature Center, that's a great one to go to.
Okay. What about, are there any specific organizations people can get involved in?
The Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation is a great one. You guys, we worked closely with foundation staff to secure funds for our Grassland Restoration Incentive Program. And so, the private bee that they depend on is something that we've put to good use and hopefully benefits the critters out there. But there's a number of others as well. We work closely with Quail Coalition, Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, the National Wild Turkey Federation. The Native Prairies Association of Texas is a really great organization that has a number of easements and properties that really have sort of preserved some of the best prairie remnants in Texas. And then there's a long list, whether it's Audubon, the Nature Conservancy. A lot of these different NGOs are doing great work out there. And so, getting involved, giving, volunteering, or just visiting some of their properties, going to their websites, reading their materials, learning what they're doing, all that is going to benefit conservation of grasslands in the long run.
Well, thank you very much, John, for being with us today and for everything you're doing to restore grasslands in Texas and beyond. We really appreciate you being with us.
It was my pleasure, Lydia. Thank you very much for having me.
Till next time, thanks for listening.
Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast is brought to you by Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, supporting high-impact conservation projects across the state. Find out how you can help at tpwf.org.